Ladies, gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the One Liner Podcast. We are going to be talking about a wide range of films, going from The Informant to Harry Brown, covering pretty much all bases. I am Scott Morris, and sitting over there is Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
No Craig Eastman this time. He's busy recording our latest adventure, but we'll tell you more about that towards the end of the film. So without further ado, let's get cracking. We have a bit of a love-hate relationship with Steven Soderbergh round about here, but I think his latest film, The Informant, with the exclamation mark at the end, which makes it quite hard to say. But I think this film falls more into the love category. It speaks of Mark Whittaker, played by Matt Damon, who is an executive in a large bio-agricultural concern, Archer Daniels Midland, who quickly turns tattletale for the FBI in an international price-fixing investigation. While he's shepherded through the process of collecting enough information to take these cartels down by his FBI handlers, including Scott Bakula, we start to notice certain quirks in Mark's character, shall we say. While, as the exclamation mark in the title and the odd 70s retro stylings given to events that actually occurred in 1992 might suggest, this isn't exactly a Michael Mann-style The Insider serious affair. It is perhaps best left to leave the rest of the plot details to be discovered by those people who want to watch it, but are we recommending that people should go and watch it? Drew, what are your thoughts?
I would absolutely recommend it. I'll just point out the exclamation mark on the end of the title had been something that had me a little apprehensive, perhaps.
Yeah.
But having seen the tone of the film, I think it's actually quite a good idea to have that, because if you don't have the exclamation mark, you do think it might be something like The Insider.
Mm-hmm.
Which it determinedly is not.
Well, certainly not, no.
Visually, certainly, it's an odd little film, because, as you say, it does look like the 1970s, the hairstyles, the clothes, yet it's, I guess, fashion just hadn't caught up with big business in the Midwest in the 1990s, or wherever it's set.
Yeah, I couldn't work out if it was trying to be just sort of to add another layer of abstraction to it, because it did seem to be everywhere, not just in, you know, Mark's home or the offices. It just seemed to be a bit of a strange quirk that it had to it, but it's a film full of very strange quirks, so it kind of worked.
Yeah, it's almost willfully absurd.
Yeah.
Which is
fitting, given the nature of what happened.
Yes, not a bad thing either. It's difficult to talk too much about it without giving away some of the plot, and the plot is very much the point of this film.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't suffice to say that it's very funny. Matt Damon is excellent in it. There's a good supporting cast. It has probably the best running gag that I've seen in a film in the last decade. I mean, it probably even outshines the we're in a tight spot type of gag from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Yeah.
And it's not what I expected at all from Steven Soderbergh. And this, as you say, we've got a love-hate relationship with him, and he's very much seems to be a good one, bad one sort of director. And given the last thing he did was The Girlfriend Experience, he certainly was due a good one. He's come through on that. But it's not a comedy in the way that the Ocean's films are, and it doesn't feel like a Soderbergh film at all, and that's probably good. It doesn't take itself in any way seriously. It's daft, it's absurd. Go see it. It's a comedy that's funny. I mean, that's largely the most important thing to know.
Yeah. I mean, I agree completely. I mean, if you are in a market for the thriller, then it's definitely not the place to go to. It sort of has the basic structure of a thriller, but with sort of a self-referential, slightly self-indulgent tone, perhaps. But it is pretty funny for all the way throughout it. Maybe not laugh out loud hilarious, but it's pretty amusing all the way throughout.
Yeah, certainly it's very witty.
It's an eminently watchable piece of light entertainment. It's probably how I'd sum it up. I mean, if you like the sort of style and toning and just acting performances of stuff like, say, the first Ocean's 11, then you'll probably like this. It feels at least somewhat similar in tone. And yeah, I enjoyed it quite heartily. And yeah, I think you should go and see it.
Yes, this is our instruction, not our suggestion, our instruction. Despite his long and distinguished career, few of Michael Caine's roles have had quite the lasting impact of The Gangster Jack Carter, a film now approaching 40 years old, so suggestions of similarities between Get Carter and his character in Harry Brown, impressively that's his 110th film, piqued the interest of many, and that includes myself. What Harry Brown is far closer to, though, is Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino, though considerably grimmer and grimier. Harry Brown lives in a council estate where, like many of the other elderly people there, he feels frightened and trapped by the gangs of recidivist youths who roam the area, intimidating the residents and, generally, making everyone's lives miserable. But do you know what? Like Peter Finch and Network, Harry's mad as hell and isn't going to take it anymore. But instead of preaching to the nation on television, he gets himself a gun and he goes a-shooting. However, whereas Gran Torino's take on elderly vigilantism was entertaining, this film mostly left me feeling dirty and uncomfortable. The problem with it is, you know, it's about vigilantism and revenge and not justice. You know, and it's therefore potentially viscerally satisfying, but it's intellectually unrewarding. The villainous hoodies of Harry Brown's estate are straight out of the pages of the Daily Fail. They're odious, irredeemable characters who prey on the weak and make the average citizen's life a living hell. They've got all the depth and dimension of a sheet of A4, so they just don't feel like real people at all. Fortunately though, there are performances to commend the film, and Michael Caine's performance in particular is good, but you know, like the film, it seems to come in two distinct halves. In the first half, we are given an indication of a helpless, voiceless population, afraid, impotent, unable to affect any change in their circumstances. And Caine's portrayal of the lonely old man, devastated by the loss of first his wife, then his best friend, is touching, it's moving, it's believable. But in the sordid revenge fantasy that's the second half, he just becomes an impassive killer, and his performance becomes more matter-of-fact and less emotional. The film has other problems too. It's burdened by entirely unnecessary subplots involving touchy-feely and apparently as useless as a chocolate kettle police officers and politically-minded police initiatives, which would seem to exist only to bring about the conditions of the film's climax.
Yes. Policing by a narrative convenience, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And because the antagonists, the baddies, fail to ring true, Harry Brown, although I suspect it thinks otherwise, has absolutely nothing useful to say about society. It's outlaw, but with better actors, i.e. it doesn't have Danny Dyer in it. And there are certainly no shades of grey to be found in the film's characters, but it's well made and well acted. It's just not well thought out, though Michael Caine's performance alone is probably enough to justify recommending you see it. Just have a shower afterwards.
Well, I think that's exactly what I said when I was coming out of the experience, didn't it? It just felt like I needed a shower. It's got that sort of grimy, sort of slightly contaminated feel to it.
It was dirty.
I think I compared it to Death Wish, directed by Ken Loach. I think I remember when I was watching it, I thought it was, if you take it just in isolation for that 100 minutes you're in a cinema, I thought it was effective and compelling, and I did like it. It was a great performance from Caine, at least for the first half of the film, and I don't think anyone else really disgraces themselves in it. But anything that does put you in mind of outlaw is definitely a bad idea. It's just set in this ridiculous, brazenly violent world that simply doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's just not society as anyone knows it. I mean, it's convenient for the story for it to exist like that, but having gangs of thugs roaming around, apparently funding the continuity IRA, if the ending's got anything to do with it, it just doesn't make any sense. And because of that, it just doesn't feel in any way real or any way true. The way that the police are seen, not just sort of overtaxed public service, but they're just seen brazenly, willfully inept. It just doesn't make any sense. The whole film feels sort of exploitative. It's like it's trying to have some sort of social commentary on a society that doesn't exist outside of someone's head and what would make a convenient narrative. And it's just quite, the more I think about it, the more annoyed I get about the film.
Yeah, it's what I was saying too. It's visceral, and that you've got these entirely
moustache twirling the evil he's going about.
Yeah, the most unpleasant people you can imagine in this film, and they make Michael Caine's life and the life of his friends very unpleasant. And in the context of the film, you're like, right, great, go get them. It's kind of satisfying. But if you apply any thought to that at all, it's like, oh, that, you kind of feel dirty for that too, because compelling as the idea of revenge may be, it's not justice. It's not the same thing. And because also, those people don't exist. They are so incredibly one-dimensional, the characters. There's an evil character and there's the good character. There's no shades of grey, there's no ambiguity, there's no depth, there's no roundness. It's worth seeing because of Caine, but it's not a good film, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean exactly. It's just full of these strange social scare tactics, and it's the sort of film that I think you might actually want to go and see, but I don't want to recommend you pay any money to go and see for, because I don't really want to encourage them, if you know what I mean. It's worth tracking down at some point, but I would just recommend stealing it rather than watching it. Let's not reward this sort of nonsense. Okay, so we're back on board the Wes Anderson Whimsymobile, this time featuring a somewhat weird but kind of effective stop-motion animation based on Fantastic Mr. Fox, the kiddie-wink book by Roald Dahl, although I have no idea whatsoever how accurate this is, although I suspect it's not entirely following the plot too closely. At any rate, Mr. Fox, who is fantastic and is voiced by George Clooney, decides that his family should not be living in foxholes, although I hear they have a refreshing lack of atheists. So he moves up the property ladder by moving into an ice old tree. However, a return to his old career as a fox thief incurs the wrath of three local, very unpleasant farmers who resolve to turf the family of foxes out in dramatic style, with all of the other woodland critters that happens to be around them taken out as well as collateral damage. They, however, are not going to take it lying down and mount a response to this, which ends in suitably dramatic style. Drew, what do you make of this nonsense then?
Like most of Wes Anderson's work, Fantastic Mr. Fox is low-key, it's understated, it's idiosyncratic, and it's whimsical. And since I like all of the rest of Wes Anderson's work, that suits me just fine. Visually, it's an odd beast, which is not a pun. The puppets with their spindly pipe cleaner legs and the strange movements of the fur and the sometimes rather Spartan sets are, I'm sure, going to put some people off, but I find them strangely charming. And strangely, it's also not about plot at all, so the fact that it's only nominally faithful to the source material in the first place and Mr. Fox's war against Bogus Bunsen Bean is really only a framework in which to hang a story of family relationships doesn't really matter. The film also it's emotionally mature and at times morally ambiguous, perhaps making it hard to fully comprehend for younger viewers, which is good. Some of the things they don't understand can, or at least should, be explained to them by their parents, a large part of what they're for, surely, and the rest of the stuff they'll work out once they've lived a little. Though here, perhaps, I'm falling into the trap of assuming that because it's an animation, children, at least partly, are who it's for. But it is based on a children's book, and unlike unequivocally for adults only Mary and Max, they will be able to enjoy it. It's a very good film. The voice acting, even for Meryl Streep, actually seems appropriate to the part and very good all around. The only two problems I have with it is, firstly, I was disappointed that I found Jason Schwartzman's performance as Ash, the fox's son, to be probably too low-key and understated to the point of seeming disinterested and poor, and in some scenes I found the lack of ambient noise off-putting. They're fairly minor points, and I'm sure that, like myself, anyone who likes Anderson's other work will enjoy this, but I just don't think it's likely to win him any new fans. It's too different, perhaps.
I did sort of enjoy it, but it's easily the least enjoyable thing I've seen from Anderson. I felt it has a strange dichotomy. I mean, it's obviously trying to be a kids' movie at some points because, you know, that's where the source material is from, but it doesn't seem to go out of its way to pander to them. But it's not going out of its way to pander to an adult audience either, which taken together accounts for 100% of all target audiences.
Yes,
so who the hell is it aimed at?
Yeah, I think there's parts. It doesn't feel self-indulgent, but possibly the person I'm pandering to is Wes Anderson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I suppose that maybe is the definition of self-indulgent, but
I still enjoyed it well enough. The vocal performances are interesting enough to sort of drive it through. The only complaint I've got with it is probably one that's, I think, we've voiced before and more general to these as a whole, but if you're going to have famous people with big quotation marks voicing characters, it does often wind up being the character itself stops being anything to do with the character, and it just becomes George Clooney voicing a fox rather than George Clooney voicing a character who happens to be a fox. It's just, you know, George Clooney the fox for some reason. And I felt that happened quite a lot. I mean, I think maybe, oddly enough, with the possible exception of Michael Gambon, this just seemed like you might as well have just replaced all the puppets with live actors. That kind of took me out of it a little bit, and it's just another sort of layer of abstraction that it really doesn't need. It's already hard enough to try and get into what this film's trying to do. While I did enjoy it well enough, I can't, in all honesty, really recommend it, because I'm not sure who would be recommending it to. It's by far from the ideal family film. It's not an ideal adults-only film, and it's not an ideal kids' film, so I don't really know what I'm supposed to be doing here. I mean, if you've got a choice between spending £20 dragging your family to see Up or dragging them to see Fantastic Mr. Fox, you should definitely be going to Up, you know? There's just better choices out there. But it's really one for people that are already joined the Wes Anderson fan club, and even then, I'm not sure they're going to get the most out of it.
No, I mean, by Wes Anderson standards, certainly it's disappointing. It seems a very long time now since Michael Jackson was a talking point because of his music career, and as more news coverage over the years focused on the eccentricities and dubious behaviours of the self-styled King of Pop, it became easy to forget what a great performer he used to be and quite how much great music he had produced. While the more serious allegations certainly shouldn't be glossed over, his announcement of a residency at London's O2 Arena with the promise of a spectacular stage show seemed to herald a return to the reason Michael Jackson became so famous in the first place. Inconveniently, both for his fans and the promoter, not to mention himself, he died.
Oh, bad planning.
That's very, very inconsiderate. Now, however, large amounts of footage of rehearsals for his O2 show were shot, and a mere 4 months after his death came the release of This Is It, a film created from this rehearsal footage. This seemed to me like it had the potential to be massively exploitative, both emotionally and financially, and was perhaps no more than a cynical way for the concert promoters to recoup their losses incurred by Jackson's death. Now, is there any truth in that, Scott, or is there something of merit in This Is It?
There is, to a limited degree, in as much as it's obviously by no means a film in any kind of narrative sense. It is obviously cobbled together rehearsal footage, but what it does do is show that despite all of the rumours that had been floating about before the run-up to his O2 gigs and before his death, I believe this shows enough to see that the man would have put on a pretty spectacular show for the people that paid their money to get there, even when he's just essentially blocking out dance routines and only half singing numbers to try and preserve his voice. The man still has more stage presence than any number of indie wannabe acts knocking about these days, and it does have something of a redemption for the man in terms of his musical career. You can really see that he does care about his craft and does care about trying to get this as perfect as he possibly could in the limits of a live show. So in that way, at least, it shows the man in a fairly positive light. I mean, it's no way to... we're probably not here to talk about his personal life, so we'll probably just leave that aside. But it's, from his professional level at least, it does a good job of showing him in a very positive light. Of course it would anyway, that's the point of this. But it also doesn't feel particularly exploitative. In fact, I cannot remember ever pointing out that he was dead during the point of it. I'm sure it must have been at some point during the end, but it didn't feel particularly exploitative, which was really my only concern going into it. As far as cinematic performances go, it's better watching this than watching Moonwalker, say.
He doesn't turn into a car?
Sadly, no.
Oh, well, I don't see it then.
Yes, so for what it's worth, I did actually enjoy this well enough for it to be worth my money. I can only really recommend it to Jackson fans. It's not going to make him any new fans, obviously. He's not exactly performing any of his music to his best, so it's not going to win over anyone who wasn't convinced of the man's talents before. But yeah, I enjoyed it well enough, and it did actually make me feel genuinely sorry that his O2 shows didn't go ahead and I couldn't perhaps go and see it.
Yeah, so if it sounds like he was back to being the great performer that he used to be before everything else seemed to take over, it really is quite a shame. But I never know, I guess. Mm-hmm. I say I guess, so if there's some doubt about it.
Yes, he's definitely not going to be as good a performer now as he was 10 years ago, unless that video for Thriller turned out to be a documentary.
Yes, given the huge amount of news coverage, he must be dead, otherwise a lot of people are going to look very, very red-faced.
Tony Yah, you may remember from the first Ong Bak film, and also Tom Yeung-gong, also called The Warrior King, and confusingly, Ong Bak 2. Gotta love international titles, especially when this one that we're about to talk about actually turns out to be the real Ong Bak 2. At any rate, Ja is the bloke who Mai Tai elbows poor Thai stuntmen in the head before doing his best to hospitalise them in a variety of brutal ways. After dissolving a successful partnership with director Prakha Pinkal, who did the previous two films I spoke of there, apparently quite acrimoniously during the shooting of this film, Ja himself steps up to co-direct this prequel with co-writer Panna Ritikai, who also is, I believe, Ja's fight choreographer and instructor, if memory serves. So at any rate, this is supposed to be a prequel to the first Ong Bak film, although with the exception of the title and the main star, this has nothing whatsoever in common with the first film, including, rather sadly, the quality of it. It's lavishly produced, I'll give it that much. While the rumoured budgets of $8 to $9 million is chicken feed by Hollywood standards, it's a lot of money for a Thai production, and to be fair, you can probably see most of that money on the screen. There's some very lavish sets and some expansive casting calls, at least. The story itself is essentially a chop-socky version of Conan the Barbarian. A young lad eventually growing up to be Tony Jaa, is taken in by a group of Robin Hood-style thieves slash warriors after his parents are murdered, and then he is trained in the fine arts of elbowing people in the head after a fairly needlessly convoluted and obfuscated plot dipping at points into black magic for no discernible reason. Jaa then heads out to avenge his parents. Drew, what did you think of the avenging?
Not a great deal. Because it's awful and has absolutely sod all relationship with the original Ong Bak. And we talked in a previous podcast, I think it was about the Thai film Chocolate, about the refreshing simplicity of that and the original Ong Bak and the Warrior King, which didn't bother some sort of daft plot, ridiculous setup. It boiled down to, this bloke done steal my elephant. I'm going to get it back now by the expedient of elbowing people in the head until I get my elephant back. And in this, he seems to have eschewed that altogether. And the one word that particularly comes to mind in regard to this film is pretentious. I think that Tony Jaa seems to have got ideas very much above his station and his ability. He's stuck in some ridiculously convoluted, very, very dull story in here, and pretty much decided to dispense with the martial arts altogether, which are mostly notable here by their absence. It's just really hard to follow simply because it's so dull, and the fact that it doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense narratively. And what made the original Ong Bak so entertaining is entirely absent. What I was imagining would be a martial arts film without any martial arts to speak of.
It's a brave move.
Brave would be one word to describe it, yes. Insane is possibly another.
It's an insane move.
And it's just, there's simply not a single thing to recommend this. It's not even like you can say, well, ignore the daft plot and just enjoy the fighting, because there isn't any.
Yeah, but that's my essential complaint with it. There's just nothing like enough action in it. I do not watch a Tony Jaa film for a insipid costume drama. I watch it to see Tony Jaa elbowing people in the head. This delivers very poorly on the elbowing in the headness, if that's actually a metric, I'm not sure. The one or two sort of big set piece action film action sequences that are there, I don't remember as being too bad. But the problem is, I just don't really remember them compared to some of the breathtaking stuff that was going through in the Warrior King and Ong Bak, the first one, and some of the just nastiest sort of bone crunching impact that you sort of immediately sort of rebound to watch again because they were so impressive. This is a massive step down and a massive disappointment. I was having a bit of a root round to see about the production of this film. It's quite storied. If even half of the things that were supposed to have happened between Joni Jaa's personal life and the financial situation of it and the relationship between him and his directorial buddy are true, then frankly it's a miracle this film got made at all, and you can kind of see why it might be somewhat less than optimal. But even if you ignore all that, and there's no reason to take it into account when you're talking about the quality of the film, it just doesn't deliver on the action, and it just doesn't deliver on the quality, and it just doesn't deliver as a film, and really cannot recommend it to anyone. Massive disappointment for me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, very, very disappointing indeed. 4 years ago, director Shane Acker produced the Oscar-nominated short Nine, an 11-minute animation with no dialogue about sentient sack dolls living in an apocalyptic wasteland. This attracted the attention of no less a name than Tim Burton, who, along with Timur Bekmambetov, produced this feature-length version, also called Nine. As apocalypse approaches and humankind is on the verge of extinction, a scientist creates nine mechanically powered ragdolls to contain the spirit of humanity, imparts a bit of his soul into each of them, and then dies. Some unspecified time later, the little dolls awaken a world that feels very much like Sony Sackboy has arrived in the Capital Wasteland from Fallout 3. A lot of the elements of the story will seem very familiar, or perhaps a more appropriate word would be derivative. Both the backstory and the enemy robot design bear more than a little similarity to the Terminator and the Matrix series, but with added Wehrmacht-inspired War of the Worlds-like tripods and Nazi dictators. Add to that rather cliched characters, Elijah Wood's Nine, the newcomer with his crazy, dangerous ideas, pitted against Christopher Plummer's priest-like number one, trying to hide away from the outside world while plotting to retain his authority, and it doesn't sound enormously promising. Now, certainly the plot isn't any great shakes. It boils down to, run away from the monsters. Ah, they got one of us. Run away from the monsters. Right, hold on. We've had enough of this. Let's attack them for a change. But there's still enough of merit here to recommend giving it a look at least. And where 9 particularly succeeds is in creating a genuine sense of peril that any and all of the characters are in danger and could die, which is a truly uncommon thing in modern film. Now, added to this are a sumptuous, detailed, and importantly, dark and scary world for the characters to inhabit. In some scenes and creatures, you know, for instance, a cat skeleton driven by gears and motors, will definitely upset and unsettle younger viewers. Please note that, you know, as with Coraline, this is a good thing. Pleasantly too, not everything about the origin of the characters is explained. There are snippets of backstory and glimpses of things like a book about the famous occultist Paracelsus, but the mystery is left hanging rather than neatly packaged and cleared up. Unfortunately, even with help from Burton and the Corpse Bride screenwriter Pamela Petler, Acker struggles to fill the modest 79-minute running time, but it's the promising director himself that is the best thing about 9. His dark style and imagination marks him out as one to watch if he can just add stronger storytelling abilities to his repertoire.
I've not seen 9, but it sounds a bit mental. Is that fair to say?
No, because most of the plot is a bit too ordinary to be mental. What is interesting is just the design of the world. It's not
post-apocalyptic sack boys. In a nutshell, that sounds fairly mental to me.
Okay, perhaps there's something wrong with me that I don't find that mental then. Perhaps it's the position you're looking at it from.
Okay.
I suggest I may already be mental. Yeah, it's the design of the world that's interesting on. So yeah. Many computer animated films are just full of garish cartoony colours, and this is something different from pretty much anything else you've seen of that type. There are a lot of darkness, muted greys and browns and greens. They just feel darker both in tone and simply in the lack of light, and it's quite refreshing from that. It just makes for a more interesting landscape. And it's that sort of thing that's compelling about it, but the story is lacking. There's nothing original about it. It's not massively compelling because it's largely a chase film with added bits of technology that are like evil but not evil, depending on what you do with them. And that feels just a bit weak.
Mm. Needs more super mutants, must try harder. B minus. Grant Heslov is perhaps best known for co-writing the excellent Good Night and Good Luck, but here he returns to the directorial chair, which he's been absent from for some years, with The Men Who Stare at Goats, starting with one of the best disclaimers in recent movie memory, that being that more of this story is true than you would believe. This goes on to tell of a young journalist, Bob Wilton, played by Ewan McGregor. After the breakup of his marriage, he decides to head off to Iraq to make a name for himself, but while waiting for clearance to enter the country, he bumps into a mysterious contractor, Lynn Cassidy, played by George Clooney, who goes on to spin him something of a shaggy dogtail, or does he? It jumps between a contemporary narrative of Cassidy attempting to fulfil a secret mission of dubious providence, and Cassidy's tale of the inception and development of a New Earth Army under Bill Django back in the 60s or 70s, I forget exactly which. These are a squad of psychic warriors, remote viewers, and self-styled Jedi. I could tell you more about this film, but you probably wouldn't believe it. Drew, is it any good?
Yes, no. It's funny, and perhaps more importantly for quite a lot of it, it's fun. I mean, it has some great comedy turns from Jeff Bridges and George Clooney, and, you know, dodgy accent aside, Ewan McGregor acquits himself reasonably well, especially given that he's pretty much a device rather than a character.
Yeah.
And Kevin Spacey is also great as Clooney's nemesis, coming close to being a pantomime villain, though in this case that's not a criticism, as it feels right in the context.
Yeah.
And it can only be improved by more footage of George Clooney in comedy wig and moustache, freeing the dance as instructed by the dude, but it could also be improved by a more coherent plot. A large part of Goats is a series of loosely connected sketches, really, with some bordering on farce. It's based on true story, and as you mentioned at the beginning of the film, states more of this is true than you would believe, but unfortunately I've not read the book in which it's based, so I've no idea what in here is invention, what's parody, and what is absurd but real. And my instinct is that there's a fair bit of all three, and they just don't sit all that well together. I also have suspicions that many of the Jedi references would have been absent from the film had Ewan McGregor not been in it, and they become a bit tawdry after a while. I mean, in the end, it's a bit of a disappointment. It's a good film, but given the cast particularly, by rights, it ought to have been a great film.
Yeah, I can agree with most of that. I don't think I was bothered too much by the tone of it, because I don't think it really warranted that amount of thought about it. But it's certainly a pleasing performance from Ewan McGregor, and it's a equally fun performance from George Clooney, who's pretty much got the market cornered in these sort of quirky, charming comedy roles. How much of it's true, how much of it isn't? Well, let's say, if you're not in the mood for a Shaggy Dog story, which, even if this was 100% true, it probably still would be a Shaggy Dog story, then this isn't a film for you. But I enjoyed it an awful lot while I was sat there in front of it. Probably will never watch it again. Probably will never think about it after I finish recording this podcast. But certainly for the length of time I was sat in front of the screen, I enjoyed it quite a lot. I was thinking, probably put me in mind of it more by the films we'll be talking about a bit later on, that this feels a lot like Burn After Reading. It's a lot of fun, but it's completely inconsequential. So I guess if you like that, then you might find some enjoyment out of this.
Yeah. Like Michael Jackson, another person whose unexpected death affected the work they were in the middle of was Heath Ledger. When he died last year, Ledger was shooting Terry Gilliam's The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Gilliam didn't have enough footage of Ledger to finish the film and wrote it off. Fortunately though, he was pushed by friends and family to find a way to complete it, so he returned to Dr. Parnassus and completed it he did, taking the novel approach of using the material Ledger had shot and supplementing it with not one but three other actors also playing the same role, namely Johnny Depp, Jude Law and Colin Farrell. So I suppose the question people would be likely to ask, Scott, would be whether these forced changes created the mess one may suspect, or whether this hangs together as a watchable film. So what say you?
Well, it is a mess, but it's a glorious mess, and it has the very distinct feeling of a mess that was always supposed to be this way. While it's perhaps shoehorned in, the changes in character make perfect sense within the plot of the story.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's the most organic way of doing this that I could have possibly thought of. It does fit very well with the internal logic of the film, so in that sense it's a massive success. The only downside being, of course, is that you've got Jude Law in the film now, which is a massive disappointment. The rest of it though is it's hard to say. I mean, I like this film an awful lot more than I could possibly justify with mathematical equations and formulas and diagrams. Like almost everything Gilliam's done, it is flawed up the wazoo. It does a lot of things wrong. A lot of it seems sort of rough around the edges. It seems to have more idea than it had budget for. A lot of it is, it's just feels a little bit unpolished. But at the same time, Gilliam makes films like no one else on the planet does.
Absolutely.
And that is always been his main selling point, and it's why you should see this film. Ledger himself gives a particularly good performance. From what he's got, massively charismatic and fits the role very well. Even Lily Cole doesn't disgrace herself. And the alternative versions of himself by the other cast are equally pleasing. Not sure what to say about it in terms of narrative. It's essentially hung around a very bizarre game for a soul between the devil and Dr. Parnassus himself, a very strange monk character who became a travelling carny sideshow attraction somehow, with people going inside of his mind, and it's all very, very strange and Gilliam-esque. That is its greatest strength, however. It's probably also its greatest weakness. But all that aside, I enjoyed it an awful lot. I'm not going to put it forward as one of the best films of the year or anything like that, but like all of Gilliam's work, it's definitely worth watching just because you've not seen anything else quite like it. Even the rest of Gilliam's work, on that basis, well worth a look at.
Yeah, it's very pleasingly different, and you're right that it is an absolute triumph that he's managed to make such a coherent, well, for given values of coherent in terms of Gilliam, such a coherent film out of having changed the character in a way that it makes absolute sense that the character within the realms of the film would look different in certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done so well, actually, that it's kind of hard to think how that could have been bettered if Heath Ledger had managed to do the full role.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is astonishing, quite frankly, and Terry Gilliam's to be nothing other than applauded for it.
Mm-hmm.
Gilliam's films are like nobody else's at all, and he's been on record too about really disliking CGI because it's trying to make things that are real rather than just using the real thing. And what Terry Gilliam does refreshingly, because I'm quite sick of CGI in a lot of films too, is that he uses the computer-generated imagery to allow the clearly, utterly mad insides of his brain be put on film in the way that he did in the hand-drawn animation used in Monty Python's Flying Circus, etc., is now done with CGI. So it's, he doesn't try to make the real world in computer graphics because he doesn't like that. He just tries to make things that couldn't otherwise be done. Mad world and a river that suddenly becomes a snake, and they're very, very trippy, but with, in Terry Gilliam's case, without the drugs. And it's just a compelling thing to watch. It's interesting, if flawed. The performances are very good, and quite how he managed to rescue the film, if it hadn't only been half shot at this point of Ledger's death, is incredible. He brought in Johnny Depp. He had, as you can imagine, a man with a very busy schedule, but agreed to do this for Gilliam, and they got that performance that makes a large part of the film possible from Johnny Depp in 1 day and I think 3 hours, he said. 1 day and 3 hours, well, that's incredible. And the work that everybody involved must have put in just to make that possible, to make use of somebody they only had for such a short time, is fantastic. And it's, I would just recommend to highlight something because it's different from anything else you're going to see.
Yeah, I mean, if I give out an award at the end of the year for merit rather than anything else, this film would definitely get it. It's trying harder than almost any film I've seen this year. It's maybe doesn't manage to reach the same levels of absolute quality as a lot of the other things I've seen, but gosh darn, it's definitely impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I hear from various sources that Joel and Ethan Coen's latest film, A Serious Man, is a semi-autobiographical tale of their combined childhood experiences, or alternatively that it's a retelling of the Book of Job, or my own theory that it's a low-key reimagining of Falling Down. After a seeming non-sequitur of a prologue, we switch to 1967 Minneapolis and physics professor Larry Gopnik, played here by Michael Stuhlbarg. His life looks to be unravelling around him when his wife announces that she wants a divorce, putting him sleeping on the couch next to Uncle Arthur, played by Richard Kind. And there may be further problems developing when a failing student seems intent on bribing him to pass the year, and this creates question marks over his applications for university tenure. Meanwhile, his son has issues with one of the local bullies. Thankfully, he can run faster than his tubby antagonist, so this never actually becomes a problem. At this point, I pretty much run out of plot points, and I'm left to throw it over to my broadcast partner for his take on this.
Well, I think largely what I have to say about A Serious Man goes, Dybbuk? Eh? Wibble, wibble, wibble. Tornado! Though perhaps you'd want to use that as the outtake at the end instead, but this is, it's an odd film. It has a beginning that has nothing to do with anything else that happens in the film at all. It has a middle that is ponderous and doesn't appear to go anywhere, and it doesn't have an ending. It's a very oddly structured film. I mean, the beginning, the prologue of the film, is so utterly separate from the rest of the film that I was convinced that it must have been a short that they decided to just stick in front of the main film, till you watch the credits at the end and see the characters from the prologue in the credits. So clearly it was part of the same film, despite in no way at all seeming like it was part of that film. I'm very much struggling to say anything about this film, and did enjoy it. Not sure why.
Well, it's very difficult to talk about it, because for the most part, nearly nothing happens in it.
Yeah, there's not much of a story, there's not much of a plot.
It seems to be a film based largely around watching Stuhlbarg sort of flounder around a bit as things start unravelling, and then it ends.
Yeah.
It's a very slender concept for a film.
Rather, it doesn't end, it just sort of stops. It
stops, yeah.
It's not the same thing as an ending, is it? I can't even say whether I think people ought to go and see it or not. I mean, if you're like me and you love the Coen brothers, you're probably going to see it anyway. If you're only familiar with the Coen brothers from, or more recently, because of the success of No Country for Old Men, you might like it because neither of those films end. But other than that, there's no similarity between them. And anybody who doesn't like the Coen brothers will only like this if they like films that are odd. I struggle to say anything about this because I'm not even entirely sure what happened in some of it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, for something that I think is labelled mostly as a sort of black comedy slash drama, there's not an awful lot of comedy and there's not an awful lot of drama. It's, I suppose it's remarkable that something that is just so slight and so almost fly away still has some layers of charm in there. And that I'm not sure what it is that the Coen brothers do. They must have some sort of magic paste that they put on actors or something to make it make it a film that has patently nothing in it. And if this had been done by anyone else, it would have been an absolutely disastrous.
Yes.
Yeah, it somehow manages to be relatively entertaining throughout. But, I mean, I wasn't bored while watching it, but I certainly cannot possibly recommend it to anyone, even people that like the Coen brothers stuff, because I have no idea why I would be recommending it.
Yes. as I would say, and there is a feeling, too, that even not so much if it wasn't directed by them, is that if it didn't have their name on it, it's the sort of thing you'd expect at a film festival, not a mainstream cinema release.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's such an odd film. And the thing is, I'm probably going to watch it again, but possibly just in the hope that I can glean something of meaning from it. the danger there is that I'm simply going to end up hating it if I watch it again, because I'm just so annoyed with the fact that nothing apparently happens. And I'm not missing some great truth in it somewhere that it was like, I was right the first time around, that it was nothing tornado.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure that's what it is. I mean, it's full of stories that go nowhere. If you do look at it as a retelling of the Book of Job, I suppose it makes at least some sense, but that's still not really worth telling again. The whole shtick with him going to various rabbis who tell him nothing of any use regarding how to deal with his life is perhaps has some meaning to those more au fait with the Jewish faith than I do, but from an impartial, well, not impartial, from an atheist standpoint, it really added nothing to it. It just reinforced the fact that there's nothing really here. It's lots of spoken mirrors and stories that circle around on themselves and end up not going anywhere at all. It's relatively amusing in places, I suppose. The sort of subplot with the professor's son essentially just getting stoned as much as he can has its moments, particularly his bar mitzvah. But there's very little there that I can point and say it was really good because of this, this or that.
Yeah, but at the same point, other than its lack of resolution, you can't necessarily point it and say this is bad either, because there wasn't anything bad about it in terms of performance or anything. But yeah, you can't recommend it.
Yeah, definitely an odd fruit. Even by the Coen brothers' standards of occasionally throwing up an oddity, this is an oddity on a whole different level. I don't know, maybe we'll look back on this in years to come and think of it as an underrated classic in the Coen canon, but I honestly don't think so. I think this will be forgotten completely and filed next to Lady Killers as something that we should probably not think of ever again. And so that rather unsatisfactory conclusion brings us to the conclusion of this podcast. This will be the last for a while of the multi-headed outings. What we're going to do is, in a bid to try and keep these things coming out a bit more regularly, is shake things up a little bit. So next time you download something from us, it will be Craig Eastman on his own talking about what films, what he's done, seen in the next week or so. After that, I'll do one by myself. Then Drew Tavendale, who's sitting over there,
hello,
will be doing one by himself as well. The last week of every month, we'll have a more standard roundtable format where we talk about any new films that may have popped up that week and also discuss the best and worst films of that month and any other points that we felt needed to be raised. Hopefully this will make us a bit more regular in our scheduling and will serve you, the public, better. If you've any comments on this and you think it's an incredibly stupid idea, then please write to us. That email address is podcast@theoneliner.com. Other than that, we'll sign off for now, and Craig will be speaking to you in around about a week or so. So it's goodbye from me, and from Drew Tavendale, it's
goodbye.
Sitting comfortably?
I am.
Then we shall begin. That would have done for an introduction, wouldn't it?